Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Author Chats. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Today, we are honored to have with us Professor Lara Bazelon of the University of San Francisco Law School to talk with us about her important and moving new book titled Rectify. Welcome, Lara.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us, and more importantly, thank you for writing Rectify. Let's start right in unpacking your title. The full title is Rectify, : The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. I think, Lara, because of the innocence movement, most of our listeners know what wrongful convictions are. But tell our listeners what restorative justice is and what it means in the context of Rectify.
Restorative justice is a centuries-old concept for how to deal with harms, both from the perspective of the person who inflicted the harm and from the perspective of the person who was harmed. So, for example, it was practiced in the United States before it was the United States by Native Americans, and it was practiced also in South Africa following the end of apartheid through the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. To give you an example, it takes these three basic questions that we ask in the criminal justice system: what crime was committed, who committed it, and what punishment is deserved. And it reframes them to ask what harm was done, who was harmed, and whose obligation is it to meet the needs of the person who was harmed. So it's coming at the idea of crime from a perspective that thinks about the offender and the victim and the larger community sitting down together in dialogue and coming up with a way to make reparations and to re-knit the community.
I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment. Cynics might say that that all sounds well and good and lovely, but it flies in the face of our traditional adversarial system, the system on which the criminal justice system in this country has been built for well over 200 years. What's your response?
It is radically different than our criminal justice system. It can exist as an adjunct to the system. It can exist after the system has failed, and that's how I talk about it in my book. Or it can exist as an alternative to the criminal justice system. So, for example, in New Zealand, they don't have what we have here, juvenile delinquency proceedings. Instead, they use a system that is entirely restorative justice based. So it isn't necessary really to have one or the other. You can have both. To be made that in certain cases it does make sense to go the restorative justice route, particularly when the traditional methods of handling a crime and its aftermath have completely failed.
Speaking of which, in your book, during particularly the first section, you talk about what are some of the hallmarks of wrongful convictions in this country. Tell our listeners a bit about what those hallmarks are.
There have been a lot of studies of wrongful conviction cases, and there's this amazing organization called the National Registry of Exonerations that tracks every known exoneration starting in 1989, and we're above 2,300 at this point. And they crunch the data and they code it. And what we know based on this remarkable work is, for example, that 55% of these cases, so over half, involve official misconduct by police or prosecutors, that in 13% of these cases, there is a false confession, and that in an alarming number of cases, there was mistaken eyewitness identification. So those are just three of the really chilling hallmarks of wrongful conviction cases.
And what is the current policy throughout this country of compensating people after having been wrongly convicted, after having sometimes spent decades in prison for a crime which they did not commit?
The problem is that it's all over the map. So In Texas, you are entitled to $80,000 a year if you have been exonerated, and also an annuity and potentially college credits. In Philadelphia, where I was born and raised, you're entitled to nothing, so you don't get a red cent. Those are just two extremes. Then in the middle, we have states that cap compensation. So in Oklahoma, the maximum that you can get is $175,000. In other states, it's $25,000. The federal government has its own level. So there is nothing uniform. And whether you are compensated or not boils down to a freak accident of geography.
If you've just tuned in, we're talking with Lara Bazelon about her important new book titled Rectify, Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. Now, Lara, tell us a little bit about the lives of exonerees after they are freed. That is to say, after they are freed from prison and the spotlight of the media goes away, and do they pick up their lives where they left off? What happens?
It's a very hard road back, and of course it's person specific, but Thomas Webb, one of the exonerees that I profiled, put it well when he said, after all the hoopla has died down and the cameras have gone away, no one cares about you anymore, you're yesterday's news. And I know there are many exonerees who feel that way, that they have their moment in the headlines, and then the next week we've all moved on, and here they are without a family, without a place to live, without any job prospects. So it can be extremely difficult. The exonerees who seem to do the best are folks who still have close family and friends who have stayed connected to them, and also folks who recognize early on that they are going to need to deal with long-term trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder, other psychological impacts and even physical impacts, and they immediately start reckoning with what's happened in a way that is hard but also aimed at this idea that they want to live a long, full life to the best that they can.
Tell us how you first got involved with wrongful convictions.
I was hired in 2012 to become the supervising attorney of a very small innocence project. And just so your listeners know, the Mothership Innocence Project was co-founded by Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld. It's located in New York. And after they founded their project, many other projects bloomed all over the country. And the one at Loyola was one of those. And my job was to work with a senior fellow and with law students to screen cases where people claimed that they were innocent, find the ones that were meritorious, and try to prove it. And at Loyola, we took only non-DNA cases. Before that, I had been a federal public defender, and so my involvement in the criminal justice system was to represent people who had been accused of a wide variety of federal crimes, some quite serious, going up against the United States Attorney's Office for the Central District of California.
Now, I have a question about the criteria. When you say that Loyola's Innocence Project only took non-DNA cases, why the criteria, and what do you mean by that?
Well, exonerations tend to break down very roughly into two categories. There are a category of cases, and the Innocence Project in New York, among others, specializes in them, that are based on DNA evidence. So evidence that's recovered and can be tested and can potentially exclude the person who's been wrongfully convicted and, in the best possible scenario, match to the actual perpetrator. Now, it doesn't mean that it's the silver bullet in all cases, because there are certainly cases where, even in the face of DNA evidence, prosecutors have pushed back. However, in many cases, when faced with DNA evidence, the other side will concede that there was a wrongful conviction. Then when you get to these non-DNA cases, and we're seeing more and more of them, it's a little bit more difficult because you don't have this magic piece of conclusive proof. And instead, what you have to do is go back and really dismantle the case against your client, element by element, fact by fact, witness by witness. We took those cases because we felt that there was a need for that. And also because taking DNA cases and paying for the testing can be extremely expensive, and we didn't have the funds to do that.
Now, one of the cases that you discussed in your book is one of the cases that made a huge impact not only on your professional life, but also your personal life. And for the benefit of those who have not read the book, I am not making this man's name up. His name was Cash Register. Tell our listeners a little bit about Cash Register.
Cash was convicted of robbing and murdering an elderly white man named Jack Sasson in 1979 when Cash was 18 years old. He is African American. The conviction turned on the testimony of two supposed eyewitnesses. As it turned out, both of those eyewitnesses were lying. And also, as it turned out, the police had covered up the existence of witnesses who, had they testified, would have shown that Cash was not the actual perpetrator. And in addition, they had lied and covered up the fact that, at least in the case of one of the witnesses, they had basically offered her a deal that she couldn't refuse in exchange for her testimony. So after this trial, in front of an all-white jury, who was out for 3 days, Cash was convicted and he was sentenced to life without the possibility of parole, which was later converted to just a straight life sentence. And he was incarcerated for 34 years.
You discuss the lives both during their incarceration as well as post-incarceration of a number of people, but there are a couple I'd like to hone in on. First of all, tell us a little bit about a gentleman named Thomas Haynesworth, and in particular, the politician who was instrumental in his exoneration.
This case is extraordinary for so many reasons. Thomas Haynesworth was accused, again, we're talking about an African-American 18-year-old, of violent stranger rapes by five different women. All of the women were white. He was convicted in three of those cases, and he was sentenced to 74 years in prison. 26 years later, one of the cases had DNA that was tested and matched a man named Leon Davis Jr., who had been arrested and convicted later that year in 12 other sexual assault cases, all with the same modus operandi, that is, a black man attacking young white women within a certain geographic radius, using a weapon, and actually even down to kind of the precise words that he used when he spoke to the victims and threatened them. So after this came to light, Thomas's attorney, this woman, Shawn Armbrust, who runs the Mid-Atlantic Innocence Project, had the task of trying to convince the prosecutors that not only should Thomas be exonerated in DNA, but that also the two remaining convictions should be vacated as well. And that was a really difficult argument to make in Virginia because the law is so rigid about who gets to be exonerated. And there was no DNA left to test in those other two cases because the evidence had been destroyed. So Sean ended up going to the local prosecutors in both of those cases, Wade Kaiser and Michael Herring, and they agreed with her that they believed that Thomas was innocent. And then the task was to convince the attorney general. And the attorney general at the time was a man named Ken Cuccinelli II. Ken Cuccinelli, who his friends and loved ones call the Cooch, is extremely conservative. And he was a Tea Party darling. He's still very, very conservative. First person to sue to stop the enforcement of Obamacare, does not believe in climate change, does not believe in gay marriage. You name an issue and he's to the right. And so there was some doubt whether, having run on a Law and Order platform, Cuccinelli would be at all sympathetic to hearing a case of this man who still had these remaining rape convictions where the two victims had not recanted and there was no evidence that exonerated him directly, but still very strong circumstantial evidence that Leon Davis Jr. had in fact committed all of the crimes. And Ken Cuccinelli, to his credit, sat down and listened to the presentation of the prosecutors and to Sean, and then he spent months poring over these cases, all 18 of them. And he came to the conclusion that, in fact, Leon Davis Jr. had done all of the crimes and that Thomas Haynesworth was innocent. And then he took the extraordinary step of making that argument to the Virginia Court of Appeals, to the full court, nine justices, many of whom were very skeptical of the position that he was taking. And so he took a lot of heat for his position, and he never wavered from his conviction that what he was supposed to do was help Thomas get out of prison and live the best life possible and stand up for his vision of the rule of law.
I'm going to ask you about one more exoneree by way of a final question, but his life, unfortunately, did not, or post-conviction life, did not have such a happy ending. Daryl Hunt. Who was Daryl Hunt?
Daryl Hunt was another African-American man in the South, in North Carolina, Winston-Salem. He was convicted of raping and killing a young white woman who worked for the local newspaper, and he spent 20 years in prison under constant threat. It was a very racialized case, and in prison he was constantly under attack by white supremacists and also by guards. And when Daryl got out, he seemed like he was doing pretty well. His attorney, Mark Rabel, had devoted his whole professional career to Daryl's case, had been the trial lawyer, the appellate lawyer, the habeas lawyer, had gotten Daryl exonerated finally, and was someone who felt quite close to him. And no one, not Daryl's wife, later estranged wife, April, not Mark, not his closest friends, knew how much Daryl was really suffering. And during the 10 years that he was out, he, again, founded an organization, and he traveled the world, and he was able to get compensated, and there was a movie made about him called The Trials of Daryl Hunt that went to Sundance. But he was quietly suffering from extreme post-traumatic distress and depression, and he was self-medicating with narcotics and not conveying that or telling anyone how badly he was hurting and that he was in need of help. And very, very sadly, when Daryl was supposed to go to a restorative justice retreat, which was the first of its kind that this organization, Healing Justice, was holding, he didn't show up. And the woman who was running the organization, Jennifer Thompson, a good friend of Daryl's, was very worried about him, called and called, no answer. And then on the last day of the retreat, Jennifer and everyone there received the horrible news that Daryl had killed himself with a shotgun sitting in a borrowed truck in a strip mall parking lot.
Ouch. Ouch. Well, and it's important to note that although you discuss a lot of cases in the Deep South, the plague of wrongful convictions occurs throughout the 50 United States. Unfortunately, Lara, we have to end, but thank you so much for joining us here on Author Chats. To all of you listeners, we've been talking with Lara Bazelon about her important book titled Rectify, The Power of Restorative Justice After Wrongful Conviction. If you care about our criminal justice system in this country, this is a book that you must read. I'm Elizabeth Kelly. Please remember, injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere.